VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. A top White House official said Wednesday at least 8 U.S. telecommunications firms and dozens of nations had been impacted by a Chinese hacking campaign. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
Deputy National Security Advisor Anne Neuberger offered the new details about the breadth of the sprawling Chinese hacking campaign that gave officials in Beijing access to private texts and phone conversations of an unknown number of Americans. Neuberger shared the scope of the hack a day after officials issued guidance intended to help root out the hackers and prevent similar cyber espionage in the future. White House officials cautioned that the number of telecommunication firms and countries impacted could still grow. Haya Panjwani, Washington.
Neuberger said the U.S. believes the hackers were able to gain access to communications of senior government officials and prominent political figures through the hack. The Chinese embassy in Washington on Tuesday rejected accusations that it was responsible. White House officials believe the hacking was regionally targeted and the focus was on very senior government officials. South Korea's opposition parties moved Wednesday to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol over the shocking and short-lived declaration of martial law that drew heavily armed troops to encircle parliament. AP correspondent Charles David Aizma reports.
Impeaching Yoon would require the support of two-thirds of parliament, and at least six justices of the nine-member constitutional court would have to support it to remove him from office. The motion, submitted jointly by the main opposition Democratic Party and five smaller opposition parties, could be put to the vote as early as Friday. I am Charles de Ledesma.
This is VOA News. Conservative U.S. Supreme Court justices signaled on Wednesday their willingness to uphold a Republican-backed ban in the state of Tennessee on gender-affirming medical care for transgender minors in a major case that could affect other state laws. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Activists both supporting and opposing the rights of minors to receive gender-affirming medical care faced off outside the U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday, while inside, the court heard a challenge to a Tennessee law banning the use of treatments such as puberty blockers and hormone therapy for patients under the age of 18 experiencing gender dysphoria. But some justices seemed unconvinced the law constituted a ban or that the court should weigh in. Here's conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
It seems that there are risks and benefits both ways here, so it's very hard to weigh those, at least as the briefing has set out the issues.
Tennessee's law is one of 24 such policies enacted by conservative state lawmakers across the country.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. New York City police officials say an American healthcare executive was fatally shot in the chest on Wednesday outside a hotel in New York. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen has more.
Police said the shooting happened in front of the Hilton in Midtown Manhattan, and Thompson was pronounced dead at a nearby hospital.
In Midtown Manhattan early this morning, 50-year-old Brian Thompson, the CEO of United Healthcare, was shot and killed in what appears, at this early stage of our investigation, to be a brazen, targeted attack. This does not appear to be a random act of violence.
The suspect fled on foot wearing a black face mask and a gray backpack.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. Cubans woke up to darkness on Wednesday as the Caribbean island's electrical grid collapsed, the latest in a string of nationwide blackouts. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolina reports.
The failure underscores the increasingly frail state of the country's grid, one that has fallen into disarray amid fuel shortages, natural disasters, and economic crisis. Shortages in the country, including food, medicine, water, and electricity, have made life increasingly unbearable, and Cubans have fled in record-breaking numbers in the past 3 years. Cuba blames U.S. sanctions, which complicate financial transactions and the purchase of fuel for the crisis.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Yafika. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, December the 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. President Joe Biden has concluded his three-day visit to Angola.
President Joe Biden arrived at Catumbela Airport in Benguela Province Wednesday morning, where he was received by Angolan President João Lourenço and his counterpart.
A new report says Africa's civic space remains mostly repressive. Activists in Chad fight against gender-based violence. A Kenyan doctors' union has this week issued a 21-day nationwide strike notice to commence December 22nd. An official of the Economic Community of West African States says Ghana's December 7th election will be free, fair, and credible.
ECOWAS has a lot of confidence in the democratic traditions of Ghana. This is about the ninth election since 1992 that Ghana has had very smooth elections.
And Somali volunteers clean years of neglected beaches. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Joe Biden has concluded his three-day visit to Angola. On Wednesday, the final day of his visit, Biden toured the Lobito Corridor, the U.S.-financed 1,300-kilometer rail line that stretches from copper-rich Zambia to the port of Lobito in the southwest nation of Angola. Veteran Angolan independent journalist Mario Paivai tells me that President Biden also held a summit with the presidents of Angola, Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and the vice president of Tanzania.
It was an epic Wednesday for President Joe Biden and, of course, for President Lourenço and all their counterparts. President Joe Biden arrived at Catumbela Airport in Benguela Province Wednesday morning, where he was received by Angolan President João Lourenço and his counterparts, President Tshisekedi from DRC, President Chilema from Zambia, and the Deputy President of Tanzania. President Joe Biden made a quick tour at Lobito Port, and he was briefed about the Lobito Corridor project by Angolan Minister of Transports and other top Angolan officials. And after that, there was the mini summit of the Lobito Corridor project with all presidents I quote before. There was a summit, I need to underline, more to underline the political will to develop the Lobito Corridor project. President Biden emphasized the impact this project will have, not only in intra-trade of Southern Africa and also the United States of America and in global trade in general. He also emphasized the impact in the development of local communities and the regional economic in Angola.
As you mentioned, there were some other African leaders besides President Lourenço. What was their reaction during this summit?
Yes, it was quite positive, especially from President Tshisekedi from DRC and President Chilema from Zambia, Angolan neighbors, and of course, direct interest in the Lobito Corridor project in terms of regional trade, development, and of course, also the Deputy President of Tanzania, which has been invited to the mini summit, said that he was quite happy to be part of this mini summit, because as you know, on the other side of the continent, in the Indian Ocean, the Tanzara project linked to the Dar es Salaam port, and the idea is to connect both the Lobito Corridor projects and the Tanzara projects in a way to facilitate trade in regional and continental terms, and of course with impact in global terms and in the development of Southern Africa. So I would say it was a major political event, which have a natural impact. But apart from that, we are aware that it's a long way to go before the Lobito Corridor projects can show some results.
Mario, as you mentioned, therefore, a long way to go before the Lobito Corridor can show progress. Is there a concern among African leaders there, the fact that President Biden will be leaving office in January and he's going to be succeeded by President-elect Donald Trump? Is there a concern that this project may not continue under President Trump?
Not at all. The next incumbent was not referred in this summit, maybe for natural political reasons, but out of the door in the corridors and the analysts and the businessmen, there are of course some concerns what the follow-up from the Trump administration. Apparently everybody is happy and believes that President Trump will support also the Lobito Corridor project.
That was Mario Paivai, a veteran independent Angolan journalist. He was speaking with me from the Angolan capital, Luanda. An official of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, says the regional body has confidence in the democratic tradition of Ghana. Abdel Fattahu Musa is the ECOWAS Commissioner for Political Affairs and Security. He says all parties have assured ECOWAS that the December 7th general election will be free, fair, and credible.
ECOWAS's expectations are very high, so ECOWAS has a lot of confidence in the democratic traditions of Ghana. This is about the ninth election since 1992 that Ghana has had very smooth, you know, elections, and they've had three tenations of power in the country. So ECOWAS's expectation is that Ghana will add, you know, to that democratic trajectory that we have seen in places like Cabo Verde, in Liberia, in Senegal, and Nigeria, and a number of other places, you know, so that we bring down that trajectory that leads to dictatorships in the region and then all that, because this is a conscious choice that the ECOWAS region has made to move towards leaders who are elected through the ballot box and not through the barrel of the gun.
Your delegation has met with President Akufo-Addo and the Ghana electoral officials. What did you gather from them in terms of whether Saturday's election will be free and fair?
Yes, we had more than an hour's interactions with the chair of the Electoral Commission, that's Jean Mensah and her team. And we also had a meeting with the president of Ghana. And we held meetings with the largest civil society monitoring group, which is called CODIO, the Coalition of Electoral Observers of the Civil Society in Ghana, who plan to deploy about 4,000 observers throughout the 16 regions of the country. All the vibes we've gotten from the three are very positive. The level of mistrust toward the Electoral Commission has come down considerably, you know, through very open and inclusive dialogue through the Inter-Party Advisory Committee, which is the umbrella body for political parties, Electoral Commission, the security agencies, and the media who work on elections. And they have assured us of their preparedness. Everything is in place, security-wise and also in terms of the secrecy of the ballot. They have assured us about that. And I think for now, we have no reason to doubt that. The president of Ghana, that is President Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo, made a pitch for continuation of the democratic traditions that he came to power through free, fair, and credible elections. And he has said his two terms like every Democrat. He never even sought to cling on to power, and he has handed over the baton, you know, to whoever is going to be the winner on the 7th of December, and that it is his responsibility to make sure that his successor also comes through, you know, these elections through fair, transparent, and secure elections in the country. He's very confident also about that. But we say, James, the taste of the pardon is in the eating. So our fingers crossed until Saturday, the 7th of December, when we are going to have the general elections.
Abdel Fattah Musa is the Commissioner for Political Affairs and Security of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. He was speaking with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, December the 5th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A global alliance of civil society organizations released Wednesday its annual report titled People Power Under Attack 2024. The report says 43 out of 50 countries and territories in sub-Saharan Africa have restricted or shut down civic spaces. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Conditions for civil society have deteriorated over the past year in 9 countries, 4 of which are in Africa, and general civic space conditions in the African continent remain repressive. According to Civicas, a global alliance of civil society organizations and activists that tracks the state of civic freedoms of 198 countries. Sylvia Baturu is a human rights lawyer and Civicas researcher. She says almost 900 million people living in sub-Saharan Africa live in politically repressed societies.
Almost 70% of the population in Africa south of the Sahara is now living within a repressed civic space. That means a big majority of the continent south of the Sahara are not able to access their rights, are not able to speak out anymore, are not able to engage even meaningfully within democracy efforts and within governance efforts.
Many governments in Africa have curtailed people's rights, the report says, and their security forces have committed violations against protesters, human rights defenders and journalists. Authorities are accused of disrupting peaceful protests by force, detaining demonstrators and prosecuting human rights defenders, protesters and journalists. The report says civic space and freedoms have deteriorated over the past year in 4 African countries, Burkina Faso, Eswatini, Ethiopia and Kenya. Kenya's ranking was downgraded from obstructed to repressed due to the government crackdown on nationwide protests in June and July, which was sparked by a proposed finance bill that sought to raise taxes. According to rights groups, more than 60 people were killed during the protests in Kenya and dozens more are missing. They blame the killings on Kenyan security agencies, a claim denied by the government. 38-year-old Edith Kamau lost her son during anti-tax protests in Kenya. She agrees with the report that her country's human rights record and civic space are not good. Kenya has changed a lot, she says. This is not Kenya which we had before. Even well-to-be people are being abducted. We normal citizens are not in a good place and we don't have enough security. Meanwhile, the report downgraded Burkina Faso's status from obstructed to repressed. Eswatini and Ethiopia were downgraded from repressed to closed, meaning authorities there tolerate almost no public dissent or demonstrations. Despite many African countries restricting civic space, some are making progress in allowing political expression and defense of human rights. According to the researchers, civic space and freedom are open in 7 African countries, including Botswana and Liberia, which have improved their conditions in the past year. Liberia witnessed a peaceful power transfer late last year. In Botswana, voters voted out the ruling party, which had governed the country since 1966, in the October presidential elections. Even before then, Civicas says civil society groups were able and allowed to push back against proposed constitutional changes. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Kenyan Doctors Union this week issued a 21-day nationwide strike notice to begin on December 22nd. In a statement published on X, the Secretary General of the Union, Dev G. Atella, said the strike has been called to push the government to fulfill its promises contained in the return to work formula. Political analyst David Monda tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that the doctors have a legitimate concern.
I think the doctors have very legitimate concerns, and I think the problem essentially is this tension between the national government and the county government. So in Kenya, the health portfolio is domiciled in the county government. But the doctors were sent out to Cuba through a bilateral agreement between the national government, meaning the Kenya government and the government of Cuba. But the county governments are being asked to reimburse a portion of the tuition for these doctors who went to, you know, went to study in Cuba. So I think that's creating the tension. And also in addition to the other controversy around, you know, legislators are asking whether, why the Kenyan doctors were going to train in Cuba and they could have got the same kind of training in Kenya. So I think those are the two big issues.
I remember the doctors went on a strike some time back and there was this return to work formula the government promised. It seems to have not met its part of the bargain.
I think the problem with the, you know, the national government especially is that right now they are broke. They don't have money. The country is in already a very crippling debt. As you can imagine, we have this problem of systemic corruption, where a lot of the tax revenue, you know, disappears and is not able to be traced. So the government finds itself signing collective bargaining agreements with the doctors, agreeing to certain terms with the doctors, the unions, and then not fulfilling them. And this has been a game that's been going on for a long, long time. I must also add that this threatened strike is also tied to the plight of the medical interns. So these are the, you know, youthful graduating apprentices that are getting into the field. And a lot of them have not been paid. A lot of them have been promised jobs when they graduate their apprenticeships, and those are not being provided. So it's a whole challenge, not only in terms of the stress on the fiscal part for the Kenya government, not fulfilling its part of the obligations, but also broader issues around hiring of medical interns and also the government being able to back up its commitments to the doctors and dentist unions that it signed.
That was David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with viewers. Douglas Mpuga. Activists in Chad have launched a campaign to educate clerics and traditional rulers against early marriages, female genital mutilation, and other harmful traditional practices on women. The campaign is part of the United Nations 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Cameroon.
Government officials in Chad say about 70% of girls under 16 are forced into marriage to men who are at times older than their parents. More than 25% of women in the conflict-ridden country say they were sexually abused.
Nous voulons riposter contre l'immunité et la culture du viol et du silence.
That's why 27-year-old Voyang Claudine is telling a crowd at N'Djamena Central Market to fearlessly denounce all forms of abuses on women and girls. Voyang says women activists in Chad strongly condemn early marriages and what she calls a culture of gang rape spreading through conflict-ridden towns and villages in Chad. Voyang is a victim of sexual violence and spokesperson for the Association of Chad's Indigenous Women. More than half of the women who asked the association for help were either sexually assaulted or raped, while about 80 were forced into early marriages by their parents, Voyang said. Activists in the Central African state say they are using the ongoing 16 days of activism against gender-based violence to educate civilians, especially traditional rulers and religious leaders, against traditional practices they say are harmful to women. Epiphany John Rang is the president of the Chadian Women's Rights League, a non-governmental organization that fights to empower women with rights, freedoms, and opportunities.
C'est sous le thème riposter et se reconstruire après les violences que nous entendons cette.
She says this year's theme for the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence in Chad, which is fight back and rebuild after violence, is a clarion call to all civilians to amplify voices of survivors. Amina Priscilla Lonko is Chad's Women's and National Solidarity Minister. She spoke on Chad State TV on Tuesday.
D'accord, apporter une réponse adéquate à ces nombreuses et fréquentes violences de son excellence.
She says Chad President Mahamat Idriss Déby, who has a strong political will to end all forms of violence, has ordered his government to make sure women who are abused or whose rights are violated have free access to justice and medical and psychological care. Moki. Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A group of Somali youth is working to protect the country's marine environment by organizing weekly beach cleanups in Mogadishu. Despite limited support, they have collected over 2 million kilograms of trash in recent months. Their dedication was recently recognized with the Global Arab Volunteer Award in Beirut, Lebanon, as Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Young people in Somalia remove plastic and other trash from beaches in the capital city, Mogadishu, as part of a cleanup initiative they started. The volunteers, many with environmental conservation degrees, also raise awareness about how pollution can harm natural resources, which localists rely on for food and jobs. Raqiya Hassan is a long-time volunteer.
We are in the 167th week of our beach cleanup campaign, and this week we focused on cleaning Lido Beach. Our goal is to protect the environment and preserve marine life.
The group was recognized with an Arab Volunteer Award in Beirut, Lebanon, in April. Abdisalam Mohammed, the group's deputy leader.
Our dedicated volunteers from the cleanup campaign have participated in international competitions because of the impact of our work, which has enabled us to win international medals.
The volunteers have made significant improvements to the beaches, gradually restoring their natural beauty. Community volunteer Usman Yusuf, who has lived in clean, well-developed cities like Berlin and Munich, encourages volunteers to uphold high cleanliness standards and see their work as a noble cause.
I encourage these volunteers to strive to replicate that cleanliness in their own country. Some young people are actively engaged in this important work.
The youth's beach cleanup initiative is commendable, but often lacks government support. Yasir Bafo, a senior tourism advisor, explains that this is not a dismissal of the youth's efforts, but rather a result of the government's focus on other pressing issues.
The efforts of these young people lack the government's role, such as offering encouragement or recognition for their contributions and hard work, which they truly deserve.
The volunteers also emphasize the vital connection between a clean environment and community health. Mohammed Sheikh Noor, VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
A court in Kenya has found the housemate of an LGBTQ activist guilty of murder in the killing of the activist whose body was discovered stashed in the metal box two years ago, according to the Associated Press. A high court judge in the western city of Eldoret said Wednesday that the prosecution has shown that Joktin Odhiambo suffocated Edwin Chuloba. He then stashed his body in a metal box that was carried onto a road with the help of his brother and cousin. Odhiambo denied killing his housemate. And that's it for this Thursday, December 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington saying, have a great day. But please be safe, whatever you do.
VOA
VOA Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source